interview with Jamil Kazum on July 16, 2006 in London. And Jamil, why don't we start with you talking a bit about your first memories in Iraq?
My first memories was, although we lived in downtown Baghdad, my maternal grandparents lived in a suburb which was predominantly Muslim. My maternal granddad was a pharmacist, and really we did not have any problems integrating. There were good friendships. My own father was an Iraqi government civil servant. His last promotion in 1947 was to a post which had to be by royal decree, which was done just like any other Iraqi. I went in a primary school. I went to American school for boys in Baghdad, and then eventually I transferred to for my secondary and higher education to a Jewish school, which I finished at age 18.
What school was that?
That was Shamash in the intermediate school.
Okay.
And eventually I had to leave Shamash because at the birth of Israel, all Iraqis employed by the government or semi-state organizations were either pensioned off, so to speak, put on pension, or outrightly dismissed from their jobs. My father had a 28-year service with the Iraqi government. He was put on pension, so to speak.
What was his job?
His last job was supervisor of accounts at the Department of Health,
okay.
Which at that time was not a cabinet, it's not a ministry of health, it was director general of health.
Okay.
And he was like the number three or four man, if you like, in that
department. Mm-hmm.
In the Department of Health, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, it became the Ministry of Health and Social Affairs.
Okay.
He had very good friends, Muslims. They used to come, for example, on Jewish holidays to come to our house, offer his respects.
Uh-huh.
And a very, very important thing happened at the birth of Israel on the 15th of May, 1948, and I was just coming to 14 years old. My father had two, one of them was a very close friend, the other one was not so close, although we knew him, who were both of them with rank of colonels in the Iraqi army.
Mm-hmm.
At about, the Iraqi government did not do anything, but there was a lot of apprehension among the Iraqi Jewish community that something like the Farhud of 1941 will take place. Before we know it, at about 3:30 in the afternoon or 4:00, the doorbell rings at home. We were living in not really a suburb, but not downtown Baghdad. And these two colonels came in uniform with their military driver in an Iraqi military jeep. They came in, they made it a point among the neighbors that they are here to come to a Jewish home. And they were speaking loudly. And one of the one of our neighbors made a like passing comment about what is going to happen to the Jews and so on. And then this one of these two colonels, in a very loud voice, he said, "Don't you worry about what is going to happen. Come 8:00, military regime will be announced.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody would dare to touch a Jewish finger, and you will be treated just like any other citizen." And this is exactly on the 15th of May, 1948, at the day the State of Israel was announced. And this has a profound effect on me, that there were good Muslims who did not have any problems with the birth of a state, of a Jewish state, while they still have Jewish friends. They did not equate in those days, not the majority did not equate Israel with Judaism.
So your father had many Muslim friends.
He did.
Some.
Yes, some. It's more. It was more like acquaintances rather than very close friends.
Right. What neighborhood did you live in?
We lived in a place called Senac, which was like the beginning of the new suburbs. Senac, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There was plenty of Jewish families living in that area, but there were also Muslims as well as many Christian families living in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. What year were you born?
I was born 1934, June
34. Okay.
And before that, we did move to a very nice suburb, mm-hmm. predominantly Muslim. But my two elder sisters and myself were growing up, and we had to be nearer. My two sisters went to Jewish schools. We had to be nearer to transport was not very good in those days, obviously. So we had to be nearer. We moved downtown.
Uh-huh.
And eventually, I went the first 2 years, like reception. Or like age 5 to 6, I did go to a Jewish school.
Mm-hmm.
I did not like it very much. We were brought up in a very, not strict, very loving, but very conservative family,
yeah.
Where the children wouldn't dare to raise their voices in their parents'
right.
presence and so on. I did not like what I saw in the Jewish schools.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved to this Senac district. And we eventually found this American school for boys.
I see.
Unfortunately, at age 12, when I should have moved to intermediate,
mm-hmm.
the founder of the school, who was called Dr. Stout, died in the States.
Mm-hmm.
And his widow could not carry on with the school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I made a move to Shamash School.
I see, okay.
Secondary.
So you were probably too young to have any recollections of Kabul.
Very, very little. I remember it was a very bad day when our house was barricaded from inside.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard some shouting, some doors being broken down, but no recollections as such.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, as we grew older, then we had all the stories, what happened on those two awful days.
Those two awful days,
that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. It was just around Shavuot in 1941.
Did you have a bar mitzvah?
Bar mitzvahs in Iraq were very, very simple, not like the lavish things we have today.
Right.
My mother's first cousin was married to the then chief rabbi of Baghdad. I remember him coming, Rabbi Sesson Chodori. He came over to our house with very, very close family and two or three of my close friends, Jewish friends. Came over in the afternoon, let tefillin in a very simple, very, very simple manner.
Yeah.
It did have a very profound religious connotations. Not like today, it's like a show-off.
Right, exactly. Right.
There was more emphasis on the religious side of it.
Mm-hmm. So, when did you eventually leave Iraq?
We left illegally in 1971, August 71.
Okay.
By the time that we left, it was literally, obviously I found out later on, but when we left, it was literally like going on a picnic. It was so well organized. By obviously, as we found out later on, by Israel in collaboration with Iran,
mm-hmm.
who was ruled by the Shah in those days,
yeah.
as well as by the Kurds in Iraq, who at that time were in a very bad conflict with the central government in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
and whom the Israeli authorities, we found out when as we left, were helped to a great deal by Israel,
yeah.
including taking their old leader, Mullah Mustafa Barzani.
Uh-huh.
He was taken to Hadassah Hospital, treated, and sent back to Iraq.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Wow.
This story was told to me by his own son.
Wow.
His own son took us.
Approximately, he was taken to?
I think maybe around 68.
Yeah.
Apparently, Israel gave them a lot of armaments, the Kurds, a lot of armaments, which they seized in the 67 war.
Yeah.
This also is relayed to me by Mullah Mustafa's son.
So, what were the 50s and 60s like, up until the 67 war? What period like?
Things were not too bad. In, as I said, from 58.
Mm-hmm.
Until 1963, we really felt like other Iraqis. As I said, students were admitted to universities and so on. Come 63, military nationalists took power in Iraq, and then things literally got from bad to worse, culminating in the 67 war. A couple of days after the war, all telephones were disconnected. Many companies received instruction from the Chamber of Commerce or from the Minister of Trade to get rid of any Jews employed by them. And in the end, it was the public hangings of 1969.
Right. Where were you then?
I was at home. We were living in a very nice suburb of Iraq, in Baghdad. In 1960, I was employed by the Danish embassy in Baghdad, and I kept that job literally until the day I left Baghdad.
Wow. What did you do on the
day? Secretarial work, a lot of dealings with the Iraqi ministries, including translating for the Iraqi for the Danish ambassador with prominent Iraqi officials, including. Danish. Danish.
Danish.
Yeah, with the Danish in Denmark.
Denmark. Okay.
Yeah. And after the 67 war, and when the government started to arrest, to interrogate many Iraqi Jews, I was very, I was in quite a state. I didn't know what the right step to take. And this I discussed with my boss at that time, who was not the ambassador. The ambassador was on holiday in Denmark. I spoke to the deputy chief of mission, whether I should resign, whether my employment as a Jew in a Danish embassy, who is, at that time was very known, very well known for their sympathies with Israel, should have a bad effect. And he said, let me think it over. I don't know whether he decided or whether he consulted the Danish authorities at that time. A few days later, he came. I thought about what you told me. And my answer is no. You keep your job as if nothing has happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, God forbid, if I should be arrested, then at least they, as my being an employee of the embassy, at least they could go and say, what happened to our secretary? Where is he?
Right.
So he said it could be to your benefit to keep your employment, which I did until literally the day I left. I did tell them, of course, I said there is a route now for the Iraqi Jews to escape Iraq, and whenever I can't take that route, I'll be simply disappearing, so to speak.
Wow. So you warned them.
I went, oh yes, I did. Upon our arrival in Tehran, I went to the Danish embassy, and they knew.
Yeah.
They had a Danish special passport issued by the Danish foreign ministry for me to facilitate whatever decision I might take, whether to settle in Europe or in Israel or...
Yeah. How do you know Danish?
No, I did not. It was a very difficult language to learn. Extreme.
Are you translating into Danish?
No, I translated Arabic into English.
Oh, into English.
Most of the affairs of, obviously, the correspondence between the Danish embassy and consulate with the Danish authorities or Danish companies who are doing work for Denmark in Iraq, obviously that was in Danish, but the communication between the Danish embassy and the Iraqi authorities and companies or semi-official companies were in English, which I translated into Arabic and vice versa.
Huh. Did you learn Danish on the job?
No, I didn't. That's what I said. It was extremely difficult language.
Yeah.
Very, very difficult to learn.
Sure.
Yeah.
So tell me about me a little bit more about your parents, and maybe your grandparents, and their experience in Iraq. Your parents probably lived during the Ottoman time. Your grandparents were probably alive during the Ottoman
My father did have an Ottoman certificate. It was because Iraq did not exist as such, as a state. And all the men who were born in the, up to I think 1918, 1916 maybe, were given, they used to call it Uthmaniyah, which means basically like an Ottoman birth certificate. More than this, my father did go to a Jewish school. There was the Alliance Française, which was one of the first Jewish schools opened in Iraq in the late 19th century.
Yep.
He spoke a bit of French and not bad English.
Mm-hmm.
And then he, as I said, he became a civil servant from a young age. My maternal grandfather was a pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
He did have a practice in downtown Baghdad, and eventually he moved to the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
And he passed away at relatively young age. He was in his early 60s,
mm-hmm.
of a heart attack. And in his funeral, my parents told me later on that there were much more Muslims who attended the funeral than Jews.
Really?
So the relationship and the friendship, the help which my father as a chemist gave to the Muslims' neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
where they were living. They had no problem. They were helpful when they needed help.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very readily forthcoming. Whatever that help was.
So, tell me about why you decided to leave, kind of the years after the 60s war.
Life became literally intolerable. There was the public hangings in 1969, when the state radio, and this is why I said in the beginning of the conversation, the difference in how the Iraqi population were reacting to Jews. We had 1948, when two colonels in full military regalia come in to a Jewish home to say, don't worry, there will be a military rule announced by the Iraqi government by 6 or 8, I can't remember. Whereas in 1969, when they had the Jewish public hangings, the state trade television was showing the public hangings, and the state radio was urging the people to go to sing and to celebrate the capture and death of those spies.
Yeah.
And this is a profound transformation of character.
Mm-hmm.
The problem here, not many Westerners are aware, the Arabs are very emotional,
mm-hmm.
and it's very difficult to depend, so to speak, on their friendship.
Yeah.
On it's not very easy.
There's no consistency.
No consistency. They are very, very emotional.
Yeah.
And I don't mind saying even some of the Iraqi Jews are the same way, you know.
Meaning that they could, emotional,
they could change in 1 minute from one extreme to the other.
Right.
But over the years, being a Jew became synonymous with being Israeli.
Yes.
And I remember once I had a very good friend of mine who lives now in Israel. He had a partnership with somebody from a very, very prominent Muslim family. They were ambassadors, they were ministers, prominent business people. And that particular partner, the Muslim partner of my friend, was educated actually in the West. He studied in, his father was ambassador to Spain and to the United Nations, the Iraqi mission to the United Nations in New York. And I think he finished his university degree in the States. And I remember a couple of weeks or 3 weeks after the Six-Day War, we went to my friend to just have a cup of coffee or whatever, myself, a friend of mine, and we went to see our Jewish friend, and the Muslim partner was there with one of his own friends. And in loud voice, that Muslim partner was telling his friend, he said, "We Arabs have absolutely no dignity left. There is 4 million or 5 million Jews, and there is 120 million Arabs. So what, we lose 2 million, 3 million Arabs, and we get rid of Israel." And this is the big transformation which happened.
Now, what did it mean for your family? What, when you were witnessing this, what was your family feeling about continuing to be there or the need to leave?
It was, we were ruled by certain circumstances, same as my friend Saeed, for example. He managed to leave Iraq in 1970. We were, how can I put it, upper middle class, the people who remained in Iraq through the late 50s and 60s were upper middle class, either employees with good jobs, good prospects, or some of them had businesses, some of them had properties, big commercial properties like my wife's parents. Mm-hmm. They had enormous properties in Basra, in southern Iraq, which they left. They had to leave to you know, to flee for your life.
Yeah.
So it was just finding the circumstances, and you know, when you are in a situation and you could carry reasonably well with your life.
Mm-hmm.
Many people obviously took the decision. They said, we cannot carry on like this. Our children are growing up. We've got to find better prospects.
Right.
For us and for our families, where our many were just carried on with their lives.
Yeah.
And I think this is what happened to us.
You carried on.
We carried on. I have three sisters, two older, one younger.
Uh-huh.
All of them were married to Iraqi Jewish men.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, the second, her husband was a businessman. He was a prominent importer of glassware,
mm-hmm,
in Baghdad with Muslim partner. Most of the Jewish business people had to have Muslim partners, otherwise they could not trade freely, obtain the necessary import license, and so on. And this partner of my brother-in-law had a deranged brother, literally mentally ill.
Oh.
And one Friday he came, or Thursday afternoon, he came to the business. He shot my brother-in-law in his face.
Oh,
luckily, the bullet went right through his lower chin. Knocked off his teeth, but it killed the bullet, if you know what I mean. He did,
yeah,
not have the force to carry on.
Wow.
Then he shot his own brother in his tummy, and then he shot himself, and luckily all the three survived. That was in 1960.
It's not an anti-Semitic, or was it?
Pardon me?
This guy,
eventually he was committed. He was in a mental, eventually he ended up in a mental hospital, but luckily all the three of them survived. That was, I think, 1950, yeah, late 59, I think. 1960, my brother-in-law left. And my brother-in-law, although he was quite young, but he liked the old way in Iraq, you know, to carry on with a certain way, like the men leave very early, having a breakfast in coffee shops with their business colleagues and so on.
Mm-hmm.
He did like that life.
Yeah.
But after that, he had a daughter and a son.
Mm-hmm.
Diana was, 6 years old? The girl was, the daughter was 6 years old. The son was coming to 4, I think. And my sister was expecting her third child.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, that is it, we're leaving.
Mm.
In the meantime, he had a brother who educated and lived in London. And he came to London. Eventually, my sister and the children stayed in Lebanon for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
He came to London to sort himself out, set the base, put his feet down, buy a house. Eventually, my daughter and the children joined him. That was in 1960, early 61. I came, as I said, I came in 1961 to visit them here with an Iraqi passport. I stayed for a month, traveled all over Europe without any problems. Came back to went back to Baghdad. So when we left, we went to Tehran, which was eventually between, probably you have heard this before, between late summer 1970, when the first lot of Iraqi Jews fled through the borders, and the end of summer 72, something like 1,700 Iraqi Jews left illegally.
Yeah. Okay.
The Iraqi government, with the pressures from other countries, relented. Mm-hmm. Started, first they said, we'll grant passports to people over 65. Then literally whoever applied got a passport.
Mm-hmm.
Got to Tehran, I found my sister to tell
her. Border,
yes.
With
Kurdish people, yes. Yeah, through the north.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so well organized. As I said, it was literally like a picnic.
Yeah.
We were treated well. Everything was so well organized.
Wow.
In the evening, the following evening, we were in Tehran. The Jewish agency had rented two hotels. They had everybody there.
Uh-huh.
They had an Iraqi member of Knesset to receive us in Tehran to try to urge the majority to go to Israel, which they did.
Uh-huh.
The absolute majority did go to Israel.
Do you remember who that was?
David Fetal.
Okay.
He was a member of Knesset.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a very prominent member of the Jewish agency. His name was Shantov. He was something else.
Mm-hmm.
He settled in Tehran in the 30s. And he was still there when we left. And he literally was whatever he wanted. I remember him taking me with him. He sat, he printed the laissez-passer to enable me to leave Tehran. He had my picture stamped on it, used all the official stamps. He just sat on a desk, opened this drawer, closed that drawer, prepared everything and gave it to an officer, said, sign this.
Wow.
Just signed it. Yes.
Huh.
And
how
he
did
was. I did not go to Israel. As I said, I phoned my sister and she said, my son is having his bar mitzvah. You're coming to Tehran, to London. At that time, as the Jews started to leave, those who had family abroad, like in the States or in Europe, the European countries, Western European countries, the States, Canada, everybody was prepared to grant them visas.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister had visas for myself, my late dad, and the two remaining sisters ready at the British Embassy in Tehran, which we did. We had it without any problems.
Mm-hmm.
I came to London, and then the rest is history.
And what do you do professionally?
I worked with my brother-in-law because he had a very expanding business.
Uh-huh.
And I stayed with him.
And what kind of business?
It was middle to lower end of the market, men's clothing,
uh-huh.
Luggage, which was coming from China,
I see.
Bangladesh.
And are you still working now?
No, I'm retired? I'm fully retired now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you have children?
We have two married daughters.
What's their name?
Sharon and Lynn.
And what is it?
Lynn.
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 L Y double N.
Okay. And they're both living in London.
Both of them living in London. The eldest married just recently, a month ago, 6 weeks ago, to Ashkenazi.
Awesome.
Thank you
okay.
very much. Thanks. Married to Ashkenazi. The younger one married my brother-in-law's nephew.
Oh, yeah?
It wasn't an arranged marriage or anything.
Yeah.
They met, fell in love.
Uh-huh. When did you meet each other?
In Iraq.
Right.
Everybody knew everyone.
Because,
in Iraq.
As I said, it was a small community.
We were second cousins, so I was brought up, the two families. Jimmy's mom is my mom's cousin.
Yeah.
So, because my mom is an only child. So his mom was like a sister. You know, they were very, very close. So we were brought up, and, you know, in Iraq, everybody knew everybody else.
Would you want me to give the microphone to Sue?
Sure, you can do that. Would you like coffee, tea? No, I'm fine with water.
Water.
Yeah.
Fine.
Remind me your name again.
Saad.
Saad, right.
Right.
So your parents are second cousins.
Yes.
Second cousins.
That's right. That's right.
And so your marriage, your wedding was in Iraq and
No, Israel.
In Israel.
In Israel. Well, I come from a, I mean, although we are related, but my background is completely different. It's because I was born in 1951. I didn't know any of my father's family. I didn't know my grandparents. They had left all but one, my maternal grandmother, who was very, very wealthy. She comes from a very wealthy family.
Which family is she from?
The Shemtov.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. She's, her father was called Yehuda Shemtov, and he
was the leader of the community.
The same family.
The same family. They were not only wealthy, but prominent.
Very prominent family.
Anybody with any problems, trade, disputes, anything, they went to them. They were fair,
right. Good
wealthy,
people.
Helpful.
Yeah, I've read a lot about them. And
so when I grew up, my grandmother, who was a Shemtov, Rena, Shemtov, was a very, very wealthy lady.
Uh-huh.
She had hundreds of acres of land in Basra and shops and you name it. My father was a solicitor, but he didn't practice.
Mm-hmm.
But my grandmother lived with us. But I was brought up from a young age. I always knew we're here, we were there in Iraq on a temporary basis.
Yeah.
This is how my mother brought us up, knowing that we're here for a while. Eventually, at some stage in our lives, we're going to leave. So, although I was brought up in Iraq as an Iraqi, but deep down, we always knew we'd end up in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all more or less when my grandmother is going to, you know, as and when my grandmother sells her property.
Right.
Because obviously, she was very wealthy, and my mum, being an only child, she would. She inherited everything anyway in 1960, because my grandmother didn't want to sell any of her properties.
My mother
inherited.
Still in Iraq.
Yeah. 1960, my grandmother passed away, and my mom inherited everything.
Yeah.
But because there were hundreds and hundreds of acres of land, it wasn't a good idea to sell the whole lot together. So my dad took it upon himself to get architects and divide. But meanwhile, you know, all these Bedouins lived in, you know, they had huts in all these hundreds of acres of land, you know. So they had to be moved out and, you know.
Right. That would have been difficult.
Was difficult. Yeah, exactly.
So they did move them?
But, well, you see, my father was dealing with architects, going to Basra, and, you know, he always talked about, oh, once we sell all the land, we're going to be multimillionaires.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually we'll transfer funds to abroad. But they took it very easy. You know, it wasn't a case of let's get on with it and move out. You know, it was always like sometime in the future.
Right.
So, you know, although we were happy, we had, as Jimmy was saying, 1958, while I was seven, 1958, when there was a revolution in Iraq. But, I mean, we didn't understand what was going on. Yeah, we just carried on with our lives, but we always knew that this is only temporary.
Right.
Now, when my mom always used to tell me stories about her family and her cousins and all these people that I just knew by name, my grandparents, my paternal grandparents, my aunts, my uncles, her cousins, they were just names, you know, just like a fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
She always used to tell us stories about this one and that one. But we carried on going to a very, very nice Jewish school, and basically the Frank Ehnig school was like home from home. You know, it's just like our life revolved around around the school. And
wow.
Up to today, I'm 55 today, and all my friends are still my school friends. And you know, and like this time last year, I was in Canada because there was a school reunion, and it is absolutely amazing. The bond that we have, I don't think any other school in the world would have the same bond that we have, whether in America, in Canada, one of them lived in Vietnam, Israel, doesn't matter where, doesn't really matter how long we haven't seen each other, but when we are together, we are just like, you know, sisters.
Yeah.
Exactly. But in our case, it was, when are we going to sell the property to move out? And then 1967, when the war broke up, I was still at school. But the year later, when you know, I finished high school, we were not accepted at university.
Right.
And then came all this, the hanging, which was, I mean, it's a day I will obviously will stay with us for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
And
where were you that day?
Well, at home, because, you know, I wasn't at university. We were not accepted at university. But it wasn't just a day. It was just the build-up from December. I think the 14th of December was the first time they showed them on set. We heard about all these people
the
that were... The first trial was on the 14th of December, I remember. And the hanging was on the 27th of January. So from the 14th of December till the 27th of January, we lived in fear. There was no reason for me to wake up early in the morning, so I used to stay up all night listening, you know, in case there's a car pulls outside the house and they come and take my father. You know, it was just like sitting by the window and listening and hoping that the doorbell would not ring. And like, I used to wake up at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and then go to sleep at 3 o'clock in the morning, because we were listening to the on the radio, you know, the trial was
broadcast.
And literally, I you cannot imagine the fear. I mean, we were too scared to leave the house after 6 o'clock, or if anybody comes to our house, they had to leave their car far away, because if you have more than two cars outside your house, you risk somebody, you know, knocking on the door and saying that there is some conspiracy going on or something like that. We lived in fear. And then after the, well, you see, the only thing, we had no telephone, so the only way to communicate is by going out for a walk on the riverside. And everybody used to go out for a walk. And this is how, this is how we used to stop and say, have you heard? This one was, you know, disappeared. The other one was captured. And we'd go home and tell my mother, and my mother would, you know, we used to go every day for a stroll on the riverside, you know,
that's how you kept them.
Well, exactly. And also, the school was still running, so although we had already left school, but we used to go to school just to listen to the news and hear what's going on, and
Now, when did your family leave? When did you leave?
But then in 1970, after the, well, the hanging, we were told to reapply to university, and I was Linda, my best friend, and I, and another seven people in, that's the university I went to Baghdad University. They accepted a lot of people, a lot of Jewish people.
In 1970.
So we were one of the lucky ones.
Uh-huh.
When we went to university, there were seven girls and two boys. I've got all the photos, obviously, to show you. The Muslims were, like, confused. They've never seen Jewish people. Because Jewish people lived in, you know, the same area, more or less. But Baghdad is very big. So there were Muslims from other areas that they heard about Jews, never seen any.
Really? Even in Baghdad?
Even in Baghdad. No, they didn't. They had never...
Oh, well, I guess at that time...
But there was about 3,000-4,000 of us.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So I mean, to start with, there were a lot of Jordanian students, Palestinian students. We were very, very scared.
Yeah.
We were really scared, and we used to stick together. I mean, the university is a big university. First year was 400 students.
Right.
There was 9 of us.
What were you studying?
Business administration and economics.
Uh-huh.
And gradually, they started to warm up to us. And eventually, I finished 2 years of university. But obviously, we're all Jewish people, but we all came first and second, you know. They couldn't
right.
go anywhere near us. But gradually, they started to warm up to us, and eventually, we had a big group of us, all the 9 Jewish girls and boys, and about 10 Muslim boys and girls that were eventually, they became like they started protecting us. If anybody would say any word about a Jew, they'd kill him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were like such close friends. I've got photos of all of them, to the extent that one of them came looking for us when he visited London. And they are Muslims. They were all Muslims. We became such good friends with these Muslims, to the extent that one day, I mean, we used to go on obviously trips. University used to arrange trips for us, and I remember one day one of the Palestinians said something like I don't know, he was hinting, oh, these Jews, and they nearly killed him. They said, they are our friends, don't you dare and come anywhere near them.
Wow.
So we were really, really well looked after, very, very much respected.
Wow.
And It wasn't bad at all. I mean, the last 2 years after the hanging, it wasn't bad at all. I mean, we had my memory of the university were very, very happy times at university. But I remember we wanted to leave Iraq, and my father, who was so scared of escaping from Iraq, because eventually we gave up. But my mom never gave up hope that she will sell her property, because we were not allowed. From 1963, no Jew was allowed to sell a property.
Right.
We were not allowed, so everything came to a halt.
Right.
All the plans of, you know.
And even in 1970, you weren't allowed?
No, we were not allowed, but they did after my brother and I. I've only got one brother who lives in Israel. My mom lives in Israel. My father passed away in 1990.
Gotcha.
But you see, what happened is my brother and I said, we've got to leave somehow. And actually, I left with Jimmy at the same time. The same group, but
I had some contact with people who were arranging these things.
Uh-huh.
And the conversation came up, and they said, we'll come with you, my wife and the
husband. Yeah. So,
But you weren't married yet then?
No, I wasn't married. I wasn't married. No. We were going out together, but you know, like, he was at a very serious job, being a working at a Danish embassy. You never know when they're going to put him in prison. It wasn't worth getting married to anyone there, because you never know whether you're going to have a husband or not.
To bring up your family in what?
No.
Right.
Yeah. And also, Jimmy wanted to come to London. I wanted to go to Israel.
Uh-huh.
And so my brother and I left together. I mean, Jimmy is saying it was a picnic, but we were scared. I mean, it took 24 hours to get to the border from the time I left. Obviously, my parents didn't want to leave because of the property. They wanted to.
So they finally just.
Well, it
did
just.
Did your parents go with you?
No. I left with Jimmy in 1971.
Uh-huh.
I went to Israel, and I've got to tell you, I saw a class of Iraqi Jews in Israel that we'd never seen in Iraq, because all the ones, I mean, most of the people I know went to universities, highly educated, spoke English. Well, not only wealthy, but I mean, upper class.
Yeah.
But we saw such low class Iraqi Jews that we were shocked. We were in a state. And everything in Israel was basically comparison to Iraq, because we really lived well there.
Yeah.
But I wanted to go to Israel, and Jimmy wanted to come to London.
Right.
So you
came right to Israel from?
Well, we went to Tehran, and from Tehran, as Jimmy was telling, you know, with my brother, we had laissez passer, you know, a travel document. We went to Israel. The reason why my parents left, I mean, my parents stayed in Iraq till 1973, And although they were allowed then to sell properties, my parents were offered, my mom had an agent in Basra taking care of her properties, and he had an offer of 50,000 dinars, which was a lot of money then, on some of her shops. But they were too scared, because my best, one of my best friends who was at university with me, Iraqis, she comes from a family of 6 children. Two of her brothers, a brother and a sister, had already left Iraq, and she had 2 brothers and a sister, her mom and dad, and they were going to leave Iraq on the Monday. My friend Dora went to say goodbye to our friends at university, because we really loved them. I tell you, we really loved all the Muslim friends that we had. Mm-hmm. They were really good to us. And my friend Dora went to say goodbye to her friends, and when she came back, there was blood everywhere, and her whole family was slaughtered, killed. Her mom, dad, 2 brothers and a sister.
Which family
was it? Kashkush.
Kashkush.
Yeah, right. Well, she's my best friend, and she was, I mean, we were together at university.
Wow.
So my parents had a passport then, but they had no intention of leaving there and then. So this happened on the Thursday. A week later, my mom and my dad decided enough is enough, you know.
Right.
And my mom's agent said, I can send you the money, just sign to sell the property,
right,
and I can transfer the money to you later. Right. They were so scared that they left 50,000 out. I mean, it's worth a lot of money today,
right,
had they taken the money out, but they decided, you know, it's not worth sacrificing their lives for the money. But my mom to this day, I mean, she's living on state pension. And she came, I mean, she was very, very depressed. I mean, luckily, my brother and I bought a 3-bedroom flat, which at the time was, wow, you know, all these Israelis thinking, oh, the Iraqis. It was like there was a sort of a grudge. Oh, you came from Iraq with money and now you've got, I mean, my parents managed to send out about £6,000, which helped us buy a property, in 3-bedroom flat in Tel Aviv. So when my mom came over to Israel, by then I had got married, because Jimmy came to Israel, we got married and came to London.
Okay.
So when they left Iraq, my brother was living in the flat, and it still is a big flat, but she had depression, she was so depressed.
Wow.
She couldn't understand, because in Iraq she had a cook and we had a maid, full-time maid, and we had a gardener who used to come 7 days a week. And my mom suddenly had to wash up and, you know,
take care of it.
We used to have someone, we used to come once a week to wash the clothes and all that to do the laundry. So she had a laundry woman and a cook and, you know, luxury life. So she was very, very depressed for quite some time.
She's still in Israel,
still in the same flat, and she's still crying over her properties. And I've got documents, I've got them upstairs, that thick, of all the properties that she owned.
Have you applied for
a
kind of application?
We have last year, but I don't put any hopes whatsoever.
Right.
And I tell you, as long as my mum is alive, you know, if she gets it, get something, some compensation, I'm fine.
Right.
If we don't get it in while she's alive, I don't want it when she's not.
Right.
I'd rather not have it when you know.
She was yearning for it so much.
Yeah. I mean, she cries. She still cries almost every day.
Wow.
And she feels sorry for herself. Living on state pension, in a flat where she used to have a big house and a garden, and also because she was an only child and her mom had her when the mother was 42 when she had. I've got photos. Well, it's not unusual, because my grandmother got married when she was 20, and this marriage didn't last more than 3-4 months. She went back to her parents because she couldn't live with this man, whoever he was, I don't know. And he wouldn't give her the get. So she stayed at my family, with her family, for 20 years until he died. So when he died, obviously she could get married. So my grandfather, who was... Yeah, it's a very, very funny story. My grandfather, who's a Shashur, my grandfather met her at a wedding, and he was 10 years younger than her. He fell in love with her, or with her money, I'm not quite sure.
Was stunning. She had the blue eyes, which was unusual. Among the Iraqis, mostly with
without protection.
Right.
So she was probably 40 when she got married to him, and she couldn't get pregnant. So he took her to Vienna, and I'm going back. My mom was born in 1925, in 1924, and I've got a photo here with her at in hospital in Vienna in 24, and she had to undergo an operation. I don't know what kind. And then she got pregnant with my mom. So imagine this baby that was born to someone who lived for 20 years without a husband. Oh. And so my mom was
pampered.
Well, pampered is an understatement, spoiled rotten. So wherever I used to go, and they, people used to say to me, do you know how your mom was brought up? You know, Arabanchi, how do you call Arabanchi?
It's like a
coach. Yeah, a coach used to pick her up in...
Coach.
I used to take her to school, and even when my mom gave birth to my brother, who's older than me, 3 years older than me, my grandmother used to come with us on the school bus and spend the whole day at school looking, taking care of my brother Morris, so that just in case he, you know, anybody hurts my brother. She was well
known. Yeah.
All day, she used to sit in the school, keeping an eye on my brother.
Nothing common. I've never heard this from any other family.
And she was, she used to wear the abaya, you know, the black abaya, and because Jewish people, they used to, not in my days. I mean, she was the only Jewish woman that I knew who used to wear the abaya, but she used to wear the abaya and sit on a bench in the school, come rain or come shine, every day.
Wait, so say again, she wanted to make sure that did
nothing untoward happened to Morris.
That's it.
That's it. Keep an eye on him. She worshipped the ground he walked on. And then come poor me. You know, the black sheep of the family. The girl, I mean, my brother was very, when he was a child, blue eyes, blonde hair, which was very, very unusual, because my father was a ginger. So my, so that's the story of my family. But I feel sorry for my mom. I tell you what, I feel sorry for her. I sometimes don't want